I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. In this episode of The Unmistakable Creative, John Bucati shares his incredible journey from college football player to becoming a rock and roll painter. John, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm very excited. I'm really happy and grateful to be here.
Yeah. So, you know, I came across you by way of one of our mutual friends and a listener of our show. And when he told me a bit about what you do and kind of the career that you've made out of your art, I thought, yeah, this is a fascinating story and I definitely want to tell it. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your journey, your background, and how that has brought you to everything that you're up to in the world today?
Oh, man. So, you know, I grew up in Kansas City, 1973, born to an NFL football player, actually AFL, Denver Bronco, my dad. So I was kind of born middle class, normal family. You know, I was always the square peg in a round hole kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Definitely hyperactive, very into nature, very just a wild child, you know, and I didn't know any better. And, by third grade, I was kicked out of private school and could not sit still. You know, I did doodle a lot somewhere around high school. After getting kicked out of another school, I started getting really into football. Of course, growing up loving football, it was my passion. I learned a lot about football through watching late night NFL films, which is, if you've ever watched the show, it's very creative. And it shows these characters of all these like really crazy NFL players. So I was really, that's what I wanted to be. Those, two archetypes kind of came out when I was in high school, you know, the reclusive, like quiet artist, and then the, you know, elusive, like freaking WWF football player. And I grew 5 inches in 1 year pretty much and just came out of my shell when I was in high school. And, you know, that led me to an art and football scholarship in college. So I went down the road to follow in my dad's footsteps and never really took art serious. It was just a hobby. So in college, when I got to Kansas University, they told me art would, you know, not coexist with football. So of course, since I was there to major in football, I just said, okay, I'll just put that off till later. Had a, you know, a decent football career, nothing spectacular but you know, I lettered and had a great time. And that was what my legacy was and probably thought it always would be. Then, you know, in, I think like 97, I went to Chicago to pursue a business career. I just wanted to party 8 nights a week, and a good suit job would be, you know, something that fulfilled that. My dad was a salesman, so I just said, I'm going to be a salesman. Somewhere along the line, about 2 years later, I lost that very good job that I had making like over $100,000, and I was suicidal. I was devastated. I had a lot of feelings that were coming back, you know, that I had buried. And somewhere along the line, I, you know, thought, well, maybe I would get back into my art, because I wanted to pursue a life of happiness. And somebody told me, if you do what you love, that's the answer to happiness. So moved back to Kansas City at that point. I'm my tail between my legs and just moved into my parents' basement and said, from the ground up, I'm going to be an artist and that's what I'm going to do. And I have to be miserable and I have to, you know, be this total, you know, like, hater and, you know, everything I thought an artist was. And from the ground up, I started again, and I started the art again. I started painting kids' rooms, and somewhere around 99, 90, 2000, right after 9/11, I started on November 29th, 2001, I started my own little show. I was bartending at a brew pub, and I decided to tell the manager that I was going to paint live, and he didn't have a clue what I was talking about. So I could see it in my head, and I just said, oh, I'm going to set up next to the musician, just free flow and just paint. It's going to be great. So he gave me the chance. I'll never forget what that meant. Because people came to see me and they had no idea what I was going to do. And I was just kind of painting with the rhythm of the music and didn't really know what I was going to paint. So every week I did that. That broke me out. Because what happened then was I exposed myself, let myself be seen, and people started, you know, taking notice. I put the paintings in the window, and every week I had a new painting no matter what, because I was so ADHD that I couldn't finish anything in the boring ass studio that I was just like, I got to do something different. So that was 2 years, and it was very successful. And what I wanted to do was go to Colorado, because 8 hours away was Red Rocks, the Fillmore, all these great music venues. And Colorado was on the up and up with music and the jam band scene. I was a huge Widespread Panic fan. And I was all about this like improv hippie, had a, you know, ponytail, lost all the weight from football. I had this new person. And that was like all exciting, you know, because I had kind of a rock bottom. And then, you know, I'm on the cover of the Denver Post. I'm painting with the bands. The bands are giving me good feedback. I'm getting in to see all these free shows. I am loving life. Love Colorado. I still do. And at that point, I ended up coming back to, back down to earth. Because when I was 33, I lost my best friend to suicide. I had addictions to everything you could think of. My dad just passed away from cancer. And that year, which I thought was going to be the best, ended up being the worst, coincidentally enough. Well, there is no coincidences. Looking back at it, even though it was one of the, you know, I lost my car, lost my gallery, I lost my girlfriend, everything you could imagine. I almost took my own life. I look back at it, that was the pinnacle for me, because at this moment, because of that year in 2007, I'm sober. I have a family. I have two kids. I have a beautiful wife. I live in New Orleans. I have, you know, my own studio. We have a couple employees here. It's a great, beautiful studio gallery. Everything I have in my life now is because of my sobriety and because of that, you know, magical, mystical, crazy rock bottom that I have. So I wouldn't trade a thing. And, you know, I hope that brings you up to speed, and I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. And as you know, somebody who's listened to multiple interviews, you can imagine it's opened up a can of worms and a ton of other questions.
Right.
You know, one of the things that's interesting to me is that you said that you had these two archetypes, one of an artist and one of a football player. And I'm interested in how people start to uncover what might be the archetypes in their lives that could lead to the things that they're called to do.
Is that the question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I sometimes look back at it and wonder that myself. So for me, it's putting together the dots in hindsight, and then that makes my memory of it profound, exciting, beside myself, you know, or outside of myself, rather. For instance, I got in a high school wreck, okay? I was 16. I was, you know, listening to Led Zeppelin, driving down the road in my neighborhood. I decided to go right through a yield sign because I hadn't seen anybody down that road in a long time. So I just said, yield, I don't really have to stop. You know, listening to Led Zeppelin, boom, go right through it. I hit a, you know, a limousine, and I go through the windshield and I get 180 stitches. And I almost die. The reason I was on that car trip is because I ran out of ink to go get a piece of art, to finish a piece of artwork that was due. So I'm thinking to myself, you know, like all I could think of is, am I going to play football again? I almost died. And all I could think about was, am I going to play football again? So I go to this festival probably, oh my gosh, 12 years later. And I had always had this horrible like feeling about that wreck, that I was unlucky, that I didn't deserve it. And, you know, I had this girlfriend at the time who said, oh, you should go back to that spot and give it gratitude and thank God you're here. And I said, oh, well, okay. Well, I always thought it was bad luck, right? So I go back to the spot and I look and I say, okay, God, I'm grateful. At that point, I was pretty much an atheist. And hated anybody who said, thank God or anything, you know? So I was just like, okay, thank God, I'm grateful. And I look up right next to me, 4 feet from the wreck, and there's this statue of an angel with wings and a palette and a paintbrush. And I'm like, holy crap. Literally, that had been there for, you know, that had been there before I had ever been there, you know? And what I learned from that is I feel like the answers are already there when you open up yourself to those, you know, to those mystical things. Because I could have said that was a coincidence, but I didn't. And then that led me to, you know, maybe 10 more stories that to me are very mystical. Because what are the chances of that, you know? I mean, that's right 4 feet where I almost bled to death. And, you know, so I don't like disclude the thought of like angels or guardian angels, you know. I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah, it does actually, which raises another question. Why is it that you think so many of us are not open to those kinds of things? Like we're not open to the mystery. And why don't we see it?
I guess, well, there's well, I think that people – if everybody believed it, then that might be a utopian society. That might, you know, and I think that everybody has a purpose, and maybe some people's purpose, you know, aren't, you know, isn't to be like this, you know, extraordinary, like Deepak person, you know, because if we were all Deepaks, that'd be a utopian society. But, you know, I don't have an answer for that. I know that when I work with people, mm-hmm. a lot of times they open up and then they create these unbelievable pieces of artwork or pieces of music or whatever that, you know, whatever they open themselves up to. I think it's the persistence and the practice that will make you, you know, your make you what you are as a creative or musician or movie maker or whatever.
Well, let's talk about football a little bit. You know, it's interesting. When I think of athletes, I can't help but think of people who want their kids to follow in their footsteps. And I am curious if there were dreams ever of making it to the NFL, especially having, you know, had a father who was in the NFL and, you know, what that relationship was like and how football actually has influenced and shaped everything else in your life.
So it's funny. My dad was an AFL Denver Broncos. So it just depends how you look at it. Because when he was doing it, he was working on the railroad after the offseason. He was like one of the first members of the AFL. Football was not that big of a deal then like it is now. And he was very humble about that. You know, a lot of people didn't even know till they found out later. But what football has taught me is, and I believe me, I threw all this out the window when I first started getting high and becoming an artist. I didn't want to do any of the disciplines that I learned in football at all. So what it's taught me today is I'm kind of wired for intensity. So when I set up to paint at Bruce Springsteen or whatnot, I am like getting ready for a football game. The same intensity. I know it sounds really cheesy and not creative, but I try. I have an hour and a half, or for Bruce, it's like 2 hours to paint a painting that could take possibly 5 hours. I've prepped, I've practiced, I've visualized, you know, I've meditated, all the things I did before a game, and I'm in movement like I was in football. Now, I'm not like running full speed and getting in the equivalent of a car wreck, but I'm moving and dancing and painting as fast and furious and hyper focused as you could possibly imagine. So I think I use it all the time. I think I have a lot of thick skin due to football because we were totally verbally abused by coaches and more so players. My running partners were freaking, you know, called me every name in the book. So when somebody comes up to me and decides to heckle me in front of thousands of people, I can either, you know, choose to heckle them back or choose to let it bounce off me. And I don't think that the you know, sensitive ponytail artist guy always has that strength, if you may call it a strength. So I use it a lot. I think what's helped me in the last like 5 years is not to deter anything away from my past. My past is my wisdom. So being vulnerable to all the mistakes that I made and all the things that happened in my life are all part of my, you know, knowledge. So I love every time I choose to, you know, learn from something that I buried in my past and open it back up, I end up getting the gifts of, you know, let's call it education.
Do you think that that intensity that you have brought from football to your art is something that people can cultivate in their own work? And the strength that you've gained from it, from taking those hits, is that something that can be developed? And if so, how?
Yeah, but I think that I was always taught that you had to be very relaxed and it had to be a very quiet place in the studio, and that there's no place for intensity in the studio. Because I have education and I have a lot of self-taught, you know, journeys in my art. So yes, if you're that type of person, I've met several musicians that were athletes and you would never know it. And I think it's really interesting that when we get to talk about the disciplines, I mean, there's a hand-eye coordination that athletes have that are, you know, totally, transferred into, guitar playing, drum playing, art, for whatever, you know, for whatever your craft is. And does that answer the question? Or
yeah, it definitely does. Let's do this. Let's talk about the year you lost your job, and the fact that it sent you into this sort of tailspin, because it seems like there are two significant periods of loss in your life. And you know, I want to talk about navigating that first one and how you pulled out of it, and how you got the gifts from it. And then I really want to dig into the second one.
Okay. So in 1999 or whatever the year was, I got the job after 5 intense interviews, got the dream, making a ton of money on the south side of Chicago. You know, I ended up taking a state insurance test and he told me if I fail it 3 times, I'm gone. Well, by the time I took it the 3rd time, I was scared to death and I lost the job due to text anxiety, in my opinion. Not only did the insurance company call it the Bucati rule, I was devastated and I was suicidal. And selfish as it may be, I had dealt with some concussions. I had dealt with some head injury that I was very stimulated due to adrenaline, caffeine, you know, drugs. And so what I did turn to was not only art, I turned to music. I remember buying a CD and a CD player and completely, I turned to really, and I'm just going to be honest with you, I turned to drugs, alcohol, music, and checking the F out. So checking out became a place where I got to go into my creative space. And in that creative space, I remember seeing a painting for $1,500. And I was like, I can do that. Now, I can sell something that I love, you know. And I was selling long distance for 2 years. Then I was about to sell insurance. So, you know, you have to kind of kid yourself to say that that's your life passion and life, you know, mission is to sell long distance. So that being said, being humble was, you know, I've always said stuff before I've done it. Hey, I'm going to run a half mile. And then, I mean, a half marathon, you know, and I have no idea. I didn't even start jogging and I sign up for it and then I go do it. People say, oh, you can't do that. You know, and I say, okay, well, I'm going to go to India and I'm going to do 100 paintings ago. By the way, I left that out, the most significant accomplishment I've ever done out of the story in the beginning. But when I went to India and did 100 paintings ago, I didn't say it 100 paintings ago. I said it before I even did one. And then I figured out how to do it, which is either, you know, stupid or just ambitious. I don't know. But, you know, like when I lost that job, I knew I was never doing that again. When I quit football, I knew I was never, ever going to do it again, you know, because it was like I was holding on to something so hard. So I think that, the gifts I got from it came much later, you know?
Yeah. Seems to always be that way, huh?
Yeah, it does.
Well, let's talk about how you started to stumble up on this sort of bizarre combination of painting to live music. Cause we've only had one other live, event artist here, a guy named Eric Wall.
Yeah.
That you might be familiar with. One of the things that interests me is how you start to connect dots and see patterns. I mean, what in the world would inspire the idea of, hey, you know what? I happen to be in this bar and I see a musician and you know what? I think I'm going to paint to the sound of music.
Okay. So when I was a kid, now I can connect the dots very clearly. When I was a kid, I used to look at Playboys. I used to see Leroy Neiman and I used to say, holy moly, I want that guy's job. He gets to go everywhere and he gets to, you know, be at the event and he gets to capture that event. Holy moly, you know, that's great. And I loved his colors too, you know, and I loved his animal prints and, you know, so that was probably the first looking back on it. I had also done I also saw Denny Dent, who basically started what Eric Wall and all those guys do in the speed painting. He started that in the 80s when John Lennon died. He did a John Lennon, and then he became very, very famous, very fast. He passed away. Matter of fact, that cover of the Denver Post was, when I moved to Denver, it said, is this the ghost of Denny Dent? Because I was doing something different, but based on that live painting. So one of my friends in the 90s pulled me out of bed to go see him at the Plaza Art Fair, and I'll never forget how intense and exciting I felt when he did like an Einstein upside down and like flipped it over, and I went, oh, that's what I want to do. That is awesome. Because I was always kind of an entertainer in the sense of a group of five people. I would tell a joke and, you know, had a lot of physical comedy. My dad was the king joke teller. He would have like 20 people around him at a wedding reception and he would be telling a joke about, you know, a British bulldog, a German shepherd and an Irish setter go into this pound, and he would say them with like an Irish accent and a German accent and a British accent. It was just awesome. So I knew that I had this like storytelling ability. But when I saw, and painting was one of my only skills after football, I flunked out of everything. I didn't do anything very well. I worked at Red Lobster. I crashed and burned at so many places. But back to your question, another guy I saw, Scramble Campbell, I was already doing my art, but when I saw him at a Widespread Panic show, that was also another reinforcement that this is what I wanted to do. And he probably in those early days had the biggest influence because when, for me, everything's visual because I could see that he did it and then I could see myself doing it, even though it was a different twist on it. It was, you know, it wasn't what he was doing at the time. It was probably goes without saying that I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now without him. So I didn't create it out of thin air, nor do I feel like I've ever created anything out of thin air.
Do you think that recognizing those kinds of moments is only something you can realize in retrospect?
You know, I think that you can find profound moments and hold on to them, like the movie Grand Canyon, when Steve Martin got in a wreck and he was a movie maker and he said, I'm changing my life and I'm not going to do violent films anymore. And like 2 weeks later, she talked to him about it and he was like, oh, who am I kidding? I'm a Hollywood producer. So I think it's the fact that they don't hold on to it at the time in a lot of cases. And I see that a lot in sobriety when I work with others and they don't remember how freaking shitty it was, you know, a year ago when their wife walked out on them or whatnot. So I definitely do think that. But I think in hindsight, it all just makes sense because you can put it into this great story. And it sounds like, you know, my whole life's been, you know, all these little mystical butterflies and unicorns. And it's not. It's here and there, or it's, at a, you know, a stoplight. You hear a song and about an eagle and then you see an eagle or whatever. Those kind of synchronicities, you have to be willingness. You have to have the willingness, in my opinion, to open up to them.
Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit. One of the things that really kind of struck or caught my attention was this idea of capturing a moment. And what I'm interested in is how you capture a moment and tell the story that is meant to be told about that moment, expressed creatively, regardless of whatever your art form is.
Well, I'm pretty process driven now. Mm-hmm. So whenever I find lack of creativity, I stick to process. So if I don't get an idea, I just say meditate. And then when I meditate, I kind of had, you know, a lot of worries that have built up and then usually I get something. Sounds corny, but I'm like, I call myself an instrument of peace. I really think that there's another universe working through me and I'm just a conduit. And, you know, I'm very big into The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. And I think the morning pages are absolutely phenomenal. But capturing a moment is a really crazy process. I'm super loose and open to anything. And in India, I walked around and I just looked for things that might be painting. And I wrote them down in a book. So for a whole day, I wrote down like 10 ideas, you know. And then like the next 3 days, I was like, oh, are we going to paint? Am I going to paint that snake charmer? Am I going to paint that? You know, that's kind of a different format. But capturing a moment, it usually speaks to me. But the other day I was in Denver, I was working for this company who hired me to do an event, and there's absolutely nothing in the moment around the party or anything to capture. So I did an abstract, and when I did that abstract, I had to overcome a lot of fear that it, you know, people would be like, what's that? And when I explained it, it made a lot of sense. Since we don't have it in front of me, I won't go there. But capturing a moment is, you know, different every time. I try to let it come to me. So that's process. And that means keeping a clear head, you know, walking around, you know, listening to other people. Sometimes somebody will come up and say something, and then somebody will say the same thing later, and then it's kind of like, well, that's obvious. You know, you got to do something with all these flags in the air at Jazz Fest, because there's like 80 flags blowing in the wind. Perfect. Ding. You know? So there's a lot of failure I haven't even touched upon. I don't think that there's an – I have this unique stupidity that I started with, that I'm going to be very, you know, nobody's going to be like me, you know, ego-driven, like, painter, that I'm going to do a different style every time. So when I started getting really psychedelic, really spontaneous, really into acid jazz, really into, like, this band Banyan and all these, like, spontaneous jam bands that were doing like 20 minute sets. I absolutely had no concept of what I was going to do that night. So I just let it fly. And then I would change. And that was my thing. Well, what happened was somewhere in the long line, I feel like I made it my mission to do something different. So I don't put a lot of boundaries on anything when I walk in to a concert or anything, because I think it's just shrinking my world by doing that. Now, do I fall back on a lot of like simple ideas that, you know, you could put into regular styles? Sure, you could see that in my work. But definitely, when I don't feel the inspiration, I just stick to the process. Like, go set up your brushes, go meditate, you know, checklist. I'm a checklist fanatic. I love that book, The Checklist Manifesto, because it made me a way better artist, because you're not a great artist if you forget your brushes one out of four times, you know. But on the other end of that, you do a pretty good finger painting if you do. So, you know, it's a lot of both. So I hope not to make total sense here, because my life, I don't feel like a lot of things make total sense.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you bring up that it's incredibly process driven. As a writer, I can tell you that the only thing I really know, I jokingly say about writing, is that I write 1,000 words every day. And it kind of goes to that morning pages thing. Even Stephen Pressfield talks about this in The War of Art. He says you're basically workmanlike. And I think that it's really easy to get caught up in this idea of waiting for some magical moment or some moment of inspiration. Whereas, you know, I think I said it before, I said, if I waited to be inspired, I'd be screwed.
Yeah.
So, well, let's do this. I want to talk in more depth about what was supposed to be the best year of your life and ended up becoming the worst. And how you navigated that time. And more importantly, how you pulled out of it. I want to dig into a bit more depth that whole period of your life.
So January, I'm super arrogant, think I'm a rock star, doing a lot of drugs, a lot of alcohol. I built a life around it. I go to bed every night at 5. I'm getting paid. I have a gallery. I'm getting paid to do whatever I want. And I've got alcohol, trade, food, living the life of like what I think is the best kind of rock star mentality. There is a, you know, let's see. There's this little feeling I got, though, when my friend Laura passed away from cancer. I started stepping out of myself and looking at, you know, what other people kind of see. And what do I want for the future? She had 2 kids. She died of lung cancer. She didn't smoke. I was still smoking, and I just started reflecting like, what a selfish son of a bitch I am. And that church in Kansas City became home base for the year, because that church 3 days later, or 6 days later, because her dad died 3 days later of a heart attack, and that just blew everybody off their feet. And same group of friends, we all met there probably 6 or 7 days later, and it was just like, you know, traumatic. And, you know, I think a month later, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. And, you know, even at that point, I'm like, holy moly, the wheels are falling off. You know, this is all happening to me. And it wasn't. It was happening. Life happens. And I think what was significant for me was when, like, Bobby died of alcoholism and by himself with a bottle of vodka, and when Mike Mizucci died of cocaine, and none of these people – nobody mentioned it, because when I drank, I was always searching for the truth, you know, the government's after you and, you know, let's get to the truth. But I didn't want to get to the truth of myself. So here we are in May, June, and I'm, you know, really struggling with alcohol. And, you know, my friend Jason, who has a little baby, he decides to kill himself, and I am literally knocked off my feet. I can't take it. My dad has cancer. A couple weeks later, my car gets repossessed because nobody wants to buy, you know, a painting from a desperate, you know, alcoholic. And I look like shit. And I think I had this girl, my dreams kind of thing, coming in and out of my life, and she left. And I just really, what I did was, I lived in October. I lost Bill Waris, who was a friend of my dad's and a friend of the family's, again, at that same church. And we all had this small, not even a small group. We were all there just kind of reflecting. And I kept coming in town. And every time I came in town, I brought my black suit. And then, crazy enough, on Halloween, because I'm an artist, I had to make this big to-do. I was in an old hotel where jazz musicians stayed, and it was abandoned, and that's where I had my studio since I had got kicked out of my gallery. I had rock bottom. I remember smashing a pint glass after I drank it when I found out my dad's cancer had metastasized or whatever, because I knew that I had lost a lot of faith and hope, because my mom said it spread all over his brain, and I knew that, you know, I was fucked. And I got down on my knees and I prayed to whatever God was up there. And, you know, because I was an artist, I said, I'm done. I'm done drinking. I can't do this anymore. And I finally, instead of trying to quit on my own, I just gave it to somebody else. And I, a couple of days later, I said, let's go party. I'm done. Halloween, I dressed up as Edward Scissorhands. I put paintbrushes instead of scissors on my fingers, and I did this crazy painting, and I never had a drink again after that night. A month later, I was lucky enough to speak, and my dad wrote a lot of poetry, but of course you're not going to feed three kids on poetry, so I read his poetry at his funeral in front of, you know, over 1,000 people, and I felt the kind of the spirit behind me while I was up there. And, you know, I had promised I was going to quit drinking for like 30 days, but I felt so damn good that I just thought I'd give it another 30 days. And like, God, 8 years later, I haven't had a drink, nor do I have the desire, nor would I ever risk all the great creative things that come from it. You know, when I was smoking weed, we always joked that weed was more important than, you know, brushes, you know, because it was such a creative outlet. I to this day, I don't think that I would have had the courage to get in front of so many people if I didn't, like, seriously smoke weed in that era every day. And I'm not trying to encourage people to smoke weed, but I have to be honest of what that felt like at the time. It gave me the courage to focus on a painting and do it and dance to music. And now I'm sure people come up to me this day and they see me kind of dancing, and I'm not as wild as I was back then, but I definitely dance and bob my head and move my body with the painting, and I keep the brush kind of dancing the whole time. And I'm sure people walk by at a concert and say, that guy is fucked up on drugs, pardon my language. So I kind of have to laugh about that. Then, you know, how did I pull out of it? I have to give AA credit, because I tried to do that on my own. And, you know, like a lot of people in the program, I'm not like super quiet about it. you know, because I think I've helped a lot of people. So I'm not one of those people that try to protect my anonymity that much. I went and did a full-blown documentary on in India, and we talked about sobriety. So having anything outside of myself, you know, prayer, meditation, journaling, I pulled out of it the first 3 months was like ridiculous. I had like spirals of notes of like morning pages, because I had the artist's way in my, I knew that there was, that was a tool, and it just came out. I had moved to Crested Butte to get sober, and I left that out of the story as well. But for a few years I was there, and I did anything possible to pull out. Yoga, sure. Kundalini yoga, sure. Yeah, I heard it's great. Heal, yeah. Sleep, yeah. Get up in the morning, sure. Hike, sure. Breathing exercises, why not? I can use anything. I had the gift of desperation, and I couldn't paint anymore because I was so, you know, the first couple months I couldn't paint very well because I didn't have that belief. So I had to really pull out of it painting live. I went to a Grateful Dead concert at the Pepsi Center. I drank a Red Bull and danced and sweat the whole time. And I said, this is it. I can do this. Because I just had given up at that point and quit for a couple months. So part of my pulling out of it was, you know, having the courage to go back into it, you know, because I always given all my inspiration to weed, almost as it being like a god, you know. And in a way it was for me, you know. Now I have now I have my own great spirit, which is nature based, and you know, it's invisible and it's formless, and it's genderless. And it works for me. And, you know, so before I paint, I say, all right, you know, great spirit, you got this. Use me as a, you know, conduit. And then at the end of the painting, I want to say, man, I did a great job. I sure am great. I sure did that painting. But in reality, I have to kind of like give it back to like a greater spirit. You know, because we all are here to serve, you know, that's it. And I'm here to serve art. So I'm very grateful that I have something that I really enjoy to serve. But I'm no different than the guy serving ice cream who's 16 years old and serving up ice cream in different colors. I'm the same guy. I just happen to be serving art to live music.
So that raises a question based on something you said earlier. You said, this is happening versus this is happening to me. And I am really interested in how you create the distinction between this is happening and this is happening to me when you're going through something so difficult.
Okay. So I heard the priest say something. Remember, I was raised Catholic, so I was totally anti-Catholic because they had pushed all this guilt onto me and I didn't deserve it. So, but during the funeral, he said, Jim Morrison was right. Nobody gets out of here alive. And I said, holy crap. I looked around and everybody in that church I knew. I knew almost every single person. I said, we're all going to die. And I was like, oh my God. And at that moment, I kind of remember going, okay, this isn't happening to you. This is happening to everyone, and it's going to happen. Everybody's going to die, and life is not that short. Life is long, and you need to make the best of it and get your crap together and start building it. Someone also said to me that, you know, you control your own destiny, and I was kind of like, well, I'm just floating around being in the now. But what I was really doing is kind of walking in circles from bar to bar. And, you know, I have the choice to, you know, I had to make a choice to go to India and book the ticket and overcome fear. But the happening to me as a self-absorbed, self-pity, way to look at something that's tragic in your life, because you can't, in my opinion, I don't think that you ever say it's happening to you. I mean, Wayne Dyer is one of my big gurus. Stumbled upon him when I was dealing with my dad's cancer, and I listened to an audiobook, and, you know, I realized that I'm responsible for everything that's happened to me, so that I don't let it hold me down. And so if you can be responsible for everything that's happening to you, then you don't need to know the difference, because you just need to react, not react, you know, you need to make a decision responsive to that happening, and that's all there is to it. There are no solutions. I mean, there are no problems, only solutions, John Lennon said, and I've used that. I've been inspired by, I mean, there was one point in life where I just lived my life through music quotes, you know, and those came from other places. They came from the speaker in my car or when I was painting, and they were, again, coming from another place, and I use those as, you know, as life tools.
Well, John, this has been really, really interesting and inspiring and thought-provoking. So I have one last question for you. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Oh, you know, I think the beauty is in the mistakes. So how you present your mistakes makes you unmistakable. That is a great question. I really enjoyed listening to that question in a couple of your podcasts, because it seems like no matter what, when people see it coming, they know it's coming. And they still get stumped by it. But that would be my answer, because the mistakes are what got me through the first 5 years, the ability to suck. Like David Grohl says, we sucked. Nirvana sucked. And we live in a world where we look at the mistakes first. I see people all the time come to my paintings. They look around with a very skeptical eye and they go, did you mean to do that? And then there's those who come into my gallery and they look at a painting and they just let, you can see their eyes light up as they're absorbing it and they're not judging it. And, you know, that becomes, you know, those are the kind of people that I like, you know, but I have to put up with the ratios. There are going to be people that don't like my work. There are people who are vocal about it when I'm painting live, you know, and heckle me. There's people that, you know, have bumped into me, spilled drinks on my paintings. Guy poured a beer on my painting at a country music concert, wiped the whole thing out. And, you know, I didn't think it happened to me. I just think it happened, although I was pretty angry about it. But whatever, what makes us unmistakable, I think what I wanted to answer the question is persistence and time. Because I think there's a lot to say about the 10,000 hours that Malcolm Gladwell talks about, because I think that people see my name over and over, and then that kind of, then they can kind of connect the art, even though it's different a lot of times. And I do sculpture, and I'm a creative director, and I've illustrated a kid's book, and a lot of them all don't look just alike, but my signature is something that's unmistakable, I think. And you see that over, you know, a 10-year period or 15-year period, that can kind of help make it unmistakable. But the funny thing is that I don't even look at myself as being unmistakable. I don't know if I am or not. I haven't really thought about it. The live painting helps, because that narrows it down to a few people when I'm doing that. So I had that instantaneously, which goes against what I said about the 10,000 hours. And, you know, just to practice. My brother-in-law played college basketball, and the reason he was a good free throw shooter is because he shot 100 free throws every day after practice with Steve Kerr. And I think these young people want instantaneous, you know, results, and you don't get that without practice. And that, you know, with football and, you know, practicing patience and practicing, you know, all the things that I've learned in the past makes me who I am. And, you know, whether it's unmistakable or not, is up to the person. The eye is, you know, the eye of the beholder.
Well, John, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story with our listeners. This has been really cool.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thanks for letting me ramble. You have quite a concept.
And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.